Welcome to The Reseller Entrepreneur, the podcast for reseller hobbyists eager to turn reselling into a successful business. Learn from Mike and other reseller entrepreneurs as they share their experiences and tips on running an online business. Here's your host, Old Fashioned Mike.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back. I want to start the show with a little bit of a confession. I don't know if a confession is the right word, but sometimes it seems like I throw together these episodes. I've said this before, and I'm going to say it again just because I want the word to get out. But I do this in a stream of consciousness many times, and largely because I come up with an idea and I, you know, on my way into the office. And my reselling business is getting so busy that, frankly, I have very little time to do this. It is Sunday morning. And I am going to release this on Thursday, but I'm recording this on Sunday morning. That is after a full work week from basically 7:30-ish to about 6 every day, and then Saturday for a few hours, and then Sunday I do this episode, and then I will then work for a few hours and go home. You know, largely for shipping, I come in because it's just I don't want to be bogged down on Monday morning. So my point is that I don't have a hell of a lot of time to do this. And as you know, I don't really push a lot of products on this show, and I don't push classes, and I don't push things that I'm trying to sell you. To be honest, that was my initial thing that I was going to do, because a lot of closed sellers, as you see, go online because they realize that they're going to hit a wall at some point in terms of income, and they want to create multiple streams of income. And, I, no problem with that. I definitely understand. But that's not me, right? I want to build a scalable business first, and then if I start doing this podcast once a week for 30 minutes, in a stream of consciousness, you get out with what you listen to, and if it helps you, great. And if it doesn't help you, I understand, and no worries. But I bring this up because I know sometimes it seems like I meander a little bit, and I'm painfully aware of it. And I probably need medication to stay on track, but I don't take it. So I apologize if you don't always get a full story, and please, if you ever need clarification on anything that you listen that you hear in this show, that you please just reach out to me via the website, and I'll be glad to get back to you. It's not a problem at all. I want to make sure that people understand what I'm saying and that I'm complete in what I'm saying. So I'm going to start that. The next subject really is just a clarification of a few things last week, based upon some comments that I got, about what I was talking about. And, you know, just to, as a refresher, I was talking about scaling your clothing business if you decide to stay in clothing. Now, I'm going to say this with a caveat, is I'm getting out of clothing. I think everybody knows that by now. And a lot of the products that I've been talking about early, especially early on the show, don't really apply outside of the clothing market. So just keep that in mind. So a message came in from a guy named Devin from the UK. I don't have a city on this, but I hope I'm not talking out of turn. I don't know if he wants to know who, his name out there. But anyway, his name is Devin from the UK. And he said, basically, he has come up with a way to scale his clothing business. And so I'm going to share it with you, because I think actually it's true. I think it's more scalable than what I was doing. And what he is focusing on is polos. That's it. He only sells polo shirts. And he said that in one of his bins that he could store up to 100 polos. Now, I don't know how big these bins are, so I can't comment to that. And that he's not really struggling for space, which is fantastic. So he probably lives in the country, I would imagine, because if he was living in central London like I did a few years ago, you could probably have two bins, and that would probably be your entire apartment. But he's probably in the country, and so he has the ability to have multiple bins. And I quickly looked at his store, and he has about 5,000 listings, roughly. In his case, it's working, and honestly, it is much more scalable than what I was doing. So he's basically understands the size limitations, obviously being in the UK, I would imagine that'd be painfully obvious. And he's obviously getting the right traction as far as his price points, and probably his buy costs are fairly low because he's in the country, maybe. I'm speculating here, but so he is doing something much more scalable. Obviously, when you start adding jeans and jackets and all sorts of stuff, you're going to take up more space, and that's the scalability issue we talked about. And just to be perfectly clear, if you have space and you add people, you can make it scalable. So I'm just saying, if you want to be a lone ranger, or maybe have you and somebody else helping you a little bit, clothing's not going to do it. But in this case, I don't know if he has any employees. He didn't mention, but he said the space requirement piece that he's addressed by going with smaller items. I would say also, if you did like bathing suits and things like that, also, I would probably stick with new bathing suits, because I don't think that the used ones really sell, or if they do, I'm not aware. At least the ones I have don't. And so anyway, so he's found a way to scale it, which is fantastic. So I guess the message for me, and maybe the message from him, is that look at items that are small. And also, I would say, if you're doing measurements, you don't have to worry about the sleeve length measurement. So that actually, believe it or not, makes it a little bit faster, because you only have to do really basically the length and the width measurements, and of course, writing in the size, extra large, large, and so on. So much faster. So, okay. Kudos to Devin for that tip. Okay. So let's go to the main subject of today. And the main subject today is okay, what do I pick? How do I pick? Because people are running into a lot of consternation. You know, so a lot of people have just done exactly what I thought they would do, is they basically took what I've said and basically made it their own. And they've gone out and, you know, I guess I say I'm probably competing with them on bidding on bulk lots of items. So in the postcard area. So, that's fine. Competition's good. The bigger the market is, the more buyers will come to it, and so on. Others have decided not to do this, and that's great too. And maybe because they don't have an interest or whatever, but they've asked, well, how do I choose? What do I choose? And so I'm going to kind of go through some things that I kind of done some cursory investigation into areas that I've also looked into, and I'm actually starting in some of them. And what I'm really looking for, again, just to reiterate, and we've talked about this before, but I'm just, in case you haven't heard it, I'm looking for size. Okay. I want something that's small that fits, that could fit multiple things in an organized way so I could find it quickly. But I want to be able to kind of scale down the size limitations, because I want to be able to keep it inside my home, for instance, so I don't have to have a warehouse. So obviously, naturally for me, paper comes to mind. And so let me go through some paper things first, and then we'll go through some others. So obviously postcards, I'll, belabor that issue. We've talked about baseball cards before. Let me reiterate that though, again, is that, what I'm looking for in anything is something that's not speculative. And I'm not saying that baseball cards or sports cards in general are speculative necessarily. There is a speculative element to them, and why I'm avoiding speculative types of things, because they're essentially fads. And so you buy something that you may pay $50 today, and then when the fad disappears, all of a sudden now it's worth nothing. I mean, look at Beanie Babies, for instance. Now, I'm not talking about, well, maybe now they have a resurgence because of, they're vintage, but maybe a better example is Pokemon cards. They surged initially, several years ago, probably 90s, I'd say. I don't really know much about Pokemon, but basically let's say the 90s. I don't think it was earlier than that. And they went away for a while, and then there was a resurgence, and through social media, juggernauts who've been promoting how great Pokemon cards are, they've gone up and up and up and up in value. So the problem with this is that if your buy costs are really, really low, then who cares, right? If you paid a penny for them, then, if it goes up to $50 and then goes down back to a penny, you really haven't lost anything other than your initial penny. The problem is that if you buy them at $50 and then they drop to $10 to $5 to $2 to down to a penny again, you're just losing money, and it's a deteriorating asset. So everything, I think, in that kind of, really the mania items that I call, basically sports cards, movie cards of the cards from like movies from the 70s and 80s and stuff like that. TV shows would probably fit into that as well. The biggest one for me now is the EFTs, and those are basically electronic art using the same technology Bitcoin uses, but instead of delivering an asset like Bitcoin, it's EFTs. And nothing wrong with EFTs. I mean, they might be interesting, but I've just read on Yahoo News a couple days ago that there was a computer generated EFT that just went for $700,000. Okay. All right. Danger. If it, you know, that is just $700,000 for a computer generated image that you know, it's a one of a kind. I get that. But the reality is that unless it's a Banksy or something that's going to be incredibly rare, not rare because they're all rare by nature, but you know, by a known artist or a known artist that's not known in the case of Banksy, then I think that actually you're just barking up the wrong tree. So I look for stuff that's not speculative or the non-speculative nature of that area. So I'm going to use sports cards again, because I've used it. I've talked about this exact same thing before, but you may have missed it. For me, a way to approach sports cards is to look for people who are long-term buyers of sports cards, who are really more in it because it's not an investment, but it's more of a throwback to childhood, for instance. And so they're looking for something that helps them remember what it was like to live in the 1980s and 90s as a teenager. And now they're maybe my age in the 50s who have the money, but they don't really want to do the speculative investments. They just want the full set of the 1986 Topps baseball cards set, which is really goes probably for $10. And by the way, probably 10 years from now, we'll probably only be going for $11. I mean, so there's not a lot of growth in those. Obviously, there's certain cards that I think are going to grow, maybe not necessarily in that particular set, but there's going to be somebody who wants to actually collect a set for all those years. And so they may have sets for every year since they were born, like I do, from 66 up to now. And I have not every single card. I didn't collect any basketball for a long time. I mean, I have some basketball now, but basically I collected only baseball cards. And I know in my collection, you know, not all of them are in the best shape, because obviously when I was a kid, I wouldn't say played with them, but I definitely looked at them a lot. But the point is I collected the full set, and I didn't collect all the sets from every single manufacturer. So there are a lot of people like me, I guess that's what I'm saying. And so what you're trying to do is you want to sell to somebody like me. And why is that? Because if the economy goes up or down, sideways, whatever, backwards, I'm going to be collecting each year. And so I'm going to try to hunt for specific cards that I need for a specific year. And so I think if you look at, and that could be the same for Pokemon cards or movie or TV cards from the 70s and 80s, all of them are have that element to them. So if somebody wants a Mork and Mindy card, you know, it's because, you know, it might be worth a ton right now. I don't know if it is or not. Who knows? But you know, I might have it because I remember Mork and Mindy when it was brand new on TV, and it brings me back to my childhood to some extent. So you're trying to sell to somebody like me. You're not trying to sell to somebody who is going to be the speculator, because if you sell to the speculator for 10 times what you paid for it, that's great. I mean, just, you know, obviously, you know, full steam ahead. And if you have an eye for, or you have a finger on the pulse of the markets, ignore what I'm saying. I'm just talking about, you know, the average kind of like the farmer type mentality we've talked about throughout these episodes. So what I would do, and I've said this before, so you could pass forward if you heard this before, but what I would do is basically collect sets or collect cards in a set, put them in order, and then basically scan each one, and then basically run a single listing on a particular set, and you not selling it as a set, but selling them individually at 99 cents, for instance, plus shipping. And then you basically, and the thing about commons on anything, whether it's any kind of card, the commons are, you're going to get them. People want to get rid of them. So there are people out there selling their entire collections because they only wanted the Michael Jordan rookie or the Tom Brady rookie, which I realized just went for like $2 million, you know. That's mania, by the way. That's a sign of mania, is if you see news stories about people buying Tom Brady cards. Tom Brady's alive and playing. You got to remember that. He's not like, and you know, Not that he's ever be a rookie again, but the point is that that's a speculative thing. And we, you know, and I don't speculate. But if I could buy an entire collection of like 40,000 cards, like I did one time, and bought them for a penny a piece, essentially, I paid $400 for 40,000 cards. That's a penny a piece. Then, you know, if I sell something for 99 cents, then just, that's 99 times my money. I mean, and then of course there's shipping. And but the thing is, in the sports card area, you don't have to offer free shipping like you do with clothing. So the point is that you're making 99 times your money, and you're just selling to that guy who just wants to buy, or woman who just wants to buy their, you know, to complete a set. That's all you're looking for. So they're, you know, they might want to be looking for something that's in good condition, as you should. But the point is, your buy costs are tiny, and you could go out and buy it all over the place, because a lot of these guys who are just basically going and buying all these 40,000 card lots only to get one thing, and the rest of them they're going to throw in the bin. And they do, by the way, throw in the bin. You just say, hey, listen, I'll buy it for you from you for a penny a card. And then you basically just turn around and resell it on eBay for 99 cents. It might take years to sell it. But you know, you could have, imagine just having one little box of cards and it's 700, almost 800 listings. So you could cycle through them very, very quickly. And then what you're doing is you're taking one listing and then you're just doing variations, right? So variation one is X card, variation two is B card, you know what I'm saying? So, and then, and I'm not sure how many variations you can have in one listing. So you might have to break it up a little bit, but that's easy. You could do that. You could say 1986 Topps baseball, you know, 1 through 300, you know, 301 through 600, you know, you get what I'm saying. So, you could do that. And, you can do this for multiple sets. And as you get in new cards that you buy into, you just filter them into this thing. You don't have to rescan them because they're already there, and you just keep the listing going. You basically just, the inventory goes to zero, and then you just add in inventory. So it's a lot of work up front, but that's how I would do cards. Now, now if you run into ones that's worth $100 and you know, hey, bonus. But the reality is that most of the time you're going to look at stuff and it says in the book, in the Beckett book, or even on eBay, it'll say 25 cents. And you're just like, oh God, 25 cents. I mean, you know, great. Am I really going to get that? You know, actually it's really the book that says 25 cents. You go on eBay, they're selling them for 99 cents, but they're doing something that I was saying what I would do. So maybe you sell for 49 cents or maybe you stay with 99 cents and you're a top rated seller. And so it won't matter because you'll, maybe you pay for a promoted listing. I don't know. I mean, you know, there's ways. But I'm saying is that you're taking something that's speculative and you're unspeculative. You're taking it and making it not a speculative type of sale. And you'll win sometimes by having stuff that's, you know, worth more. And, you know, obviously don't throw it away, continue to do it. But the reality is that, you know, you're focusing on a low acquisition cost. So that's the baseball card thing. What are other ones? Matchbooks are really good. You know, they don't bring in a ton of money. Their sell-through rate's pretty low. They're like, it's like 2%, but the storage costs are really low. I think there's some, and I got this from the auction professor, just FYI. So I want to give him credit for that. Because I didn't really think about this. I knew about matchbooks, but I didn't know that you can only send matchbooks by ground if they have matches in them because they're flammable. So, the issue with ground though is it's not cheap. So, So to me, in my way of scaling, I would not sell matches unless they were really, really high end ones with that were shaped in a specific way. I would not sell, matchbooks filled. I would probably, flay them out. So they're kind of like you could scan them, but that's another one. Okay. So, Victorian trade cards, those are basically call it business cards from the Victorian era, you know, 1880 through let's say 1910. They have names of businesses on them. They're kind of ornate and they're kind of neat looking, and you can get some pretty decent money for them. Also very, very scalable, very small, very easily to stored. So that's another one. Cabinet cards. We talked about cabinet cards are very much, they're basically old photographs that are mounted to a mounting, and it has the name of the photographer and so on. So you kind of get a little bit of a history of maybe who this person was, or at least where they're from. Old photographs. Another really, really good one. Slides, old slides, believe it or not, old slides from like, especially if they take something interesting, right, are also very, very good. Again, a very scalable item. And what makes them scalable? So storage is one we talked about. Okay. Also, instead of taking individual photographs of items, you want to be able to scan them using some kind of automatic feed in the scanner. And there are various scanners for different types of media, of course. So anyway, magazines would be another one. Really good magazines. So I have a large collection. I just bought them from a large collection of Playboys from the 50s and 60s. I haven't gone through them yet, so I don't know how they're good. But I'm kind of figuring out how I'm going to package them up, because they're slightly larger than a normal magazine mailer. And you need to put them in a cardboard backer so they don't get ruined in shipment. But what makes this scalable is you could send it book rate or media rate, I think they call it. So it's cheap. And you could charge for it, because it's in that particular area. People are not used to free shipping, or they don't really worry about free shipping. But if you want to offer free shipping, it's book rate. So it's going to be fairly, really inexpensive. So magazines are a really good one. I just started buying some newspapers. I bought a whole lot of various newspapers for things like the Kennedy assassination, the stock market crash. What else do I have here? I'm looking. Presidential elections. And I've gotten these things at pretty good rates. The key is to keep the acquisition cost. Now I'm a little bit leery of newspapers, because they deteriorate really, really quickly. These are in fairly decent shape. A couple here are not. Here we go. Man landing on the moon. Utica, man lands on the moon. Okay, this is, so somebody on the original Apollo mission was from Utica, apparently. So, but newspapers are a good thing, and you need to be able to store them. And you just store them in file cabinets, probably the best way to put it. And you'd have to have a folder system, just similar to the bag system we talked about under clothing, and the envelope system that I use, which is similar to the bag system that I use for postcards. But like storage, you're looking at acquisition costs. Now, if you want to stay in clothing and you can acquire clothing for a buck a piece, that's fine too. So if Devin from the UK is buying something at a buck or a pound, I guess in his case, a pound, and he's reselling it for 20 pounds, and he's got plenty of storage, but so the acquisition costs are got to be really, really low. You don't have to worry. You don't want to worry about too much about being upside down when you sell something. So the buy, sell, double money thing that I've talked about ad nauseum still applies, but your acquisition cost and your shipping cost should be nil, or very little, very close to nil. Nil meaning zero in this case.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You love listening to podcasts, but have you ever thought about starting your own podcast? Maybe you want to build a brand, grow your business, or are looking for an excuse to talk about your favorite hobby. Whatever your reason for making a podcast, Buzzsprout is the place to start. Since 2009, Buzzsprout has helped over 300,000 people launch their own podcasts. Buzzsprout walks you step by step through the whole process and will give you powerful tools to start, grow, and monetize your podcast. Ready to get started? Click the link in the show notes to get our free step-by-step guide to starting your podcast today.
Okay, pens. Pens are a really good one. I think storage is kind of storage is very easy, but I think you'd have to have something really easy to make sure you can find them quickly, because in scalability, not only is, like I said, acquisition costs important, shipping costs is important, and storage is important. So is the ability to find your product when you sell it. So you got to really think about how you're going to do that. I would probably put them in envelopes. And have those envelopes numbered and then in order in some kind of box of some sort. But you want to be able to quickly get to it. But again, it's lightweight, so shipping's going to be low, and people don't expect free shipping in pens. And if they did, it would go for really low, 3 ounces or less, first class postage. It's basically $3, anywhere from $3 to $4. You just build that into the price, what I prefer is to actually add it as an additional charge, so that people, when they negotiate with you, they in their head are negotiating for the price of the item. So a lot of times in clothing, I'm just using an example, is that when they say, I'll pay $25, and then you say, I have to ship it for $5. I mean, so it's really $20. They don't really think of it in that way. So if you want to charge for shipping, you still get that top seller badge, which is important, but then, they're not negotiating with you on the price of shipping. They're really just negotiating the price of the item. So that's really kind of what I think that we take that anchor away from them. So right now they're anchored on that price, and that anchor meaning that they, you know, they think, well, this is what I should pay for it total, but that, you know, they don't want to pay for shipping. And so you have to think about it, though, as a seller. So the nice thing is that anchor doesn't exist in a lot of these collectible markets because they're used to paying shipping. And so if they ever get to the point where they're not paying shipping, then we could, that's a different story. And some people get around this by saying, well, I'll just send it out in a regular envelope, but with an envelope, there's no tracking. And when there's no tracking, then there's a lot of fraud because a lot of people say, oh, I didn't get it. And then you can't refute them by saying, well, you know, here it shows delivered. Well, you don't get that option. So you want to have tracking there. So part of your scalability is to be able to track what you send out. And I don't mean your tracking. I mean U.S. Postal Service or UPS or whatever tracking. Okay, let's talk about stuff that's not paper related. I guess pens aren't paper related, but what about cosmetics? So if you want to sell cosmetics, really good. Now, cosmetics have a shelf life, and you got to worry about that, but take away the shelf life for an instant and know that you could do the exact same thing you do with pens. You just basically store in an envelope that's in a certain order or whatever, but you could have a lot of them. Now, the nice thing about cosmetics is that you can usually find pallets of this stuff and you could buy pallets and have it delivered, and they have a pretty decent sell through rate. And you just have to know what the product is, though. You have to have a lot of knowledge, and if it's not your area. So for instance, I probably wouldn't sell cosmetics because I don't wear them. And yeah, I could figure them out and probably understand what's good and what's not good and so on. It's not an area that interests me either. So, but it does have all the other elements of being scalable. Right? It's small. The acquisition cost is low. They easily be stored. They're cheap to send out. You could probably offer not free shipping, I think. Don't know for sure, but, and it has the ability to order a bunch more. Okay. Another one that's not paper, flags. Believe it or not, flags sell really, really well on eBay. Now, there's some issues around certain flags. Like for instance, if you're selling a Confederate flag, it's probably not going to be easy to do anymore. Not trying to make a political statement there, just say, you know, they're not allowing the sale of Confederate flags in a lot of places. The Gaznan flag, which is the basically don't tread on me flag, same thing, I think. That one's probably a little bit less controversial, but, you know, that same kind of area. But flags have a pretty good sell-through rate. They compact very, very small. You can even buy small ones if you want to go really, really, you know, scalable. There's probably a way you can order them from a manufacturer so they can be sent to you. And you, like I said, the acquisition cost if you buy a lot of them could be very, very cheap. So it has all the elements. So you get it. Small electronics may be another one. Handheld electronics, for instance. Of course, you got to watch out for that because, you know, other than vintage electronics, usually handheld electronics, you know, as the seasons, as the technology changes, you know, so does the value of your inventory. So there's a little bit of a downside for that. So my point is overall strategy, small, cheap, reasonably good return rate. You know, you want to basically, you got to do more than double your money. You want to make 10 times your money, right? Stuff that's easily organized, so it's easy to find. And you want to be able to find it in the marketplace so you can buy it. Now, the real money is in buying huge lots of things and parting it out. So I'll just use postcards because that's what I do. Now is I buy lots of 1,000 postcards, and out of the 1,000 postcards, I might get it for, let's say, $200. So that's basically an acquisition cost of like 20 cents. Acquisition cost of 20 cents a piece. I know I'm going to sell them from, you know, let's say the low end is $10. The high end will be 50 or 60 bucks. You're not going to go too high. I mean, occasionally you'll find something that's worth 80 bucks, but the reality is that most of the stuff's worth between $15 and $20. But you know, people who sell these in lots, they don't want to look through them. You know, they just want to take their thousands, get their quick 200 bucks, but you're doing the effort to list them. And, you know, since you can list them quickly, which is another thing that you're looking for, you know, it's very, very simple to make money on this. So I have a quick little story and we're getting near the end here, but, you know, what I do is I buy large lots, and then out of the 1,000, maybe let's say 500 of them, so 50%, I'd say, and this is totally off the top of my head, but 50% of it's going to be junk. It's junk, meaning the stuff, it's like the card's fine, but it's not something that's going to sell very much. And if it does sell, it's going to sell for like $5, right? So what I've been doing is I take those 500 and I put them in a box, and then when I buy two boxes, then I basically end up with one of the boxes being a full box of stuff that I don't sell, and then I'll resell it on eBay for, and I'll list it for $250, and I'll probably get like 150 or maybe, yeah, but 150. And I used to think that I was like, oh, wow, well, you know, listen, I'm buying something, I'm spending $400, I'm getting 150 of it back. So my real acquisition cost is $350 for 1,000, but 1,000 good ones. And so obviously that's a 35-cent purchase per card. And I'm selling it for, let's say, between, let's say 10, the very low end, and up to 50 or 60 bucks at the high end. Most of the stuff's going to be in the 10 to like the 15 to 20, like I said. But what the story is really interesting is that I sell it back, and then there's a woman that bought it from me. And then she, you know, we talked a little bit, and what she does is that she lots them up in by state. So the cards will have different states like New Jersey, New York, California, et cetera. And she'll lot them up and she'll sell them in lots of 50 for $12, but she'll sell everything, but she sells it in lots of 50 and for 12 bucks. And you know, plus she charges for postage. But what's cool about that, you think about that. So there's a market for everybody. She buys them for me for 12.5 cents and she sells them for 25 cents each. So she doubles her money. So she, I don't know if she's a listener here, but you know, the reality is that she is doing it. She has a market for something that I didn't think there was a market for. So she's got a scalable business. So I was like, you know, so there's plenty of people out there doing that. But the reality is that she is taking something and parting it out. All she has to do is she has to sort through them really quick and just determine what state they are. And she, you know, if they're Christmas cards and something like that, she sets them aside and sells those separate in a different lot, but that's how she does it. And so think of that though. I buy a bunch from eBay who don't want to part it out. I part it out for the stuff I have, and the stuff that I can't part out, I give to her and she parts it out. And so it's moved through three hands. You know, this person who originally sold it to me for $200 probably got it in an estate sale, or maybe they have a antique store someplace in the Midwest and they just don't sell a lot of cards. And so they just basically, when they get them in, they just basically put them on eBay and try to get rid of them for a little extra cash. And then, so you see what's happening here is that each of these things are scalable businesses. You could do that in clothing too, just not very likely, frankly. Anyway, so that's kind of cool. So I look at, you know, so I look at eBay to buy, look at Mercari to buy, look at Facebook Marketplace to buy, Craigslist. You could put ads in Craigslist and Facebook Marketplace that you buy collections. You should go to shows when they come back. And by the way, the sports cards shows, the same thing. In the paper area, they're called ephemera shows. E-P-H-E-M-R-A. Is that right? Anyway, ephemera shows or postcard shows, for instance, for postcards itself. Regular antique shows have pens, for instance, or other small knickknacks that might sell well. There's also a really good marketplace that that Goodwill has, Goodwill Shop. I think goodwillshopping.com, I think it is, that you can find large numbers of antiques. I've started to deal in vintage paper as well. So in other words, I have officer commission documents from the World War I, I think I talked about before, and World War II, and I think Korean War as well. I just bought a whole bunch of photographs from in the Vietnam War, and I, you know, there are 200 of them, and I'm going to sell them individually for probably $10 a piece, except for the ones with like really kind of cool things on them. And people do buy these things. They're just slower sell-through rate, and certainly more susceptible to economic forces. However, I think that you're selling for 10 bucks. You know, it's pretty easy to sell even during a bad economy. But I'm not going to lie to you. I mean, you know, clothing always does reasonably well because, you know, people need to dress whether it's a bad economy or not. And they're, especially in a bad economy, they're going to be looking for cheaper deals on eBay or Poshmark or Mercari. So anyway, that's the full story. That's probably, I've given a lot of information in this episode. We've gone a little bit over, but I think that you'll notice that, you know, there's a lot of meat in this episode. And remember, as a final parting shot, you can bypass all the scalability issues if you are willing to use money to buy space and people to help you. So if you are hell bent on staying with, you know, buying large things and warehousing and things like that, you know, just figure out ways to streamline it so that you can scale it. But you are going to need people and you are going to need space. Both equate to money and both eat into your margin. Okay. Well, thank you very much. And like always, I want you to go to the website, support the sponsors that help keep this program afloat. Even though I don't really make a lot of money on it, it does pay for the various subscriptions I need to actually run this podcast. Thank you very much, and we will see you real soon. See you next week.
This episode has ended, but your journey towards turning your reselling hobby into a business doesn't have to. Head on over to oldfashionedmike.com for more information and tips on running a successful reselling business. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss an episode. Until next time.